Please.
Does it show that it's recording? There we
Yeah, we're all
go.
set. Thank you, Charlie.
Yeah.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is a bargaining session that we have added to our schedule between the bargaining team for the United Faculty of Florida at the University of Central Florida and the team representing the UCF Board of Trustees. And glad to see everybody's here this afternoon and must not be having too many difficulties with the weather, but hopefully we'll get something done here this afternoon. To begin, Charlie, I'd like to ask that you show us the minutes from our last meeting on June 12th.
Yeah.
Salat, any comments on those?
No, it looks good to me.
Okay.
Anybody on my team looks fine. Joanna is there. Yeah. Hi, Joanna. Yeah.
Blue
Oh, she's
screen.
here then. Then. Okay.
Looks good.
All right, I will take that as us having jointly approved those minutes. Thank you very much. Well, the next thing, Talat, that we have proposed for the agenda is for us to present an Article 23, the salaries article for you. I'd like to begin, first of all, just thanking you and your team and the bargaining unit for your patience as you know the university worked through the details on this this article. We're very glad to be here this afternoon presenting Article 23. Hoped we would do it sooner, but we can't look back. We got to look forward. We're here today, and we're glad that we're here and able to present this article to you. As we go through Article 23, I think what you'll see is we've probably proposed more changes than we typically would in Article 23. And truthfully, the UFF gets some of the credit for that because I think some of the input that we've had from the UFF has been instrumental in getting us to the point where we are with the proposal that we'll present this afternoon. If I don't say it again, I want to say it now. We heard you on some of the things that you said. We heard you.
We appreciate that.
Well, thank you. With all that said, there's still a finite pool of resources that we have. So what we're going to outline is, you know, how we propose to go forward to make what we think is the best use of the resources that we have available to us. Because there are quite a few changes, I think some of them very significant in Article 23. I'm hoping I'm asking for the opportunity to present the entire article before we really open it up for discussion or
Okay.
questions, because I think some of the things that we're looking at are changes that are linked to other changes and so on. And rather than maybe analyzing each change individually at the outset, we ought to look at all of them and talk about them collectively. Of course, if there's anything that isn't clear as we go through the presentation, that please interrupt me and ask about that. So with all that said, Charlie, I'd like you to put up Article 23. The first thing that we want to show you is a change to Section 23.1 and some of the evidence that I suggested where we've heard you. What we are proposing here is that the promotion salary increases for associate professors, that's going from assistant professor to associate professor, would increase by 2% to 11%. And the promotion salary increases for those going from associate professor to professor would also increase by 2% to 12%. It's only the promotions from assistant to associate and from associate to professor that we're proposing as changes. And you know, you've pointed out to us that some of our sister institutions in the state have numbers similar to these. These are actually the ones that you had suggested to us. And we are proposing that we proceed with those. As we move to section 23.3, we've included a very short statement that reminds us that for the academic year 23-24, we did not offer a salary increase or a one-time payment. And, you know, I don't think that's a surprise. As part of the salary package that we want to offer in Article 23, one component of that is a one-time payment for the 24-25 academic year. And ideally, what we'd like to do is make that payment effective October 11th of this fall, which would mean it would be distributed on November 1st. And we think that's admittedly optimistic right now. I think Charlie's even added a note here that says, you know, we probably have to come to agreement on the entire collective bargaining agreement by September 6th to be able to make that happen. But we want to say this is our goal. This is what we like to do, with the understanding that both the union and the administration have a ratification process that we have to go through as well. So we can't just agree today, oh, this sounds great, and implement these things right away. We also have to take care of the rest of the collective bargaining agreement. So what we are proposing is a one-time payment for ENG employees who continue from the 23-24 academic year into the 24-25 academic year, who got satisfactory or above on their annual evaluations for 23-24. If there are people that were employed, there was not an annual evaluation performed, we'll do what we've done in the past and say we're going to treat that as a satisfactory so that the person is not disqualified, not a person who is otherwise eligible is not disqualified because an annual evaluation was not completed. What we're proposing is something similar to what we did in the spring of 22, really in June of 2022. At that time, we had a one-time payment where the amounts for the one-time payment were higher for the employees with the lower salaries. And there was a fairly precipitous drop in those as the salaries went up. What we're proposing this time is fewer levels of salary that we're talking about, and we're not proposing such a steep slope in the amount. So the employees with salaries less than $50,000 would get a one-time payment of $4,500. Between $50,000 and just under $100,000 would be $4,000. So it's decreasing, but not decreasing as quickly as we saw last time. And there aren't as many levels that we're looking at. This one-time payment is based on the employee's salary at 1.0. If there are employees whose FTE is below one, we're going to raise their salary to figure out which row in this table applies to them. They would get that one-time payment, but then prorated based on their FTE. So there's,
Eric, if I may ask, do we still have employees who are less than 50,000?
There are a few, yes.
But probably very few, right?
I don't remember the precise number, but
I think the number was 16. It was 16 last time when we talked. So, okay.
That's close. You know, I don't know that it's still 16, but that's close. So that's the first component of the program that we would like to implement. We'd also like to implement what we're calling a merit salary increase. And this is different from the merit salary that we implemented last time. where we looked at the specific ratings. People who got outstanding got a larger percentage in their unit than the people that got above satisfactory on the annual valuations. This particular merit increase would go to all the employees again, all the E&G employees who had evaluations of satisfactory or above. The goal is to make this increase effective October 11th and paid on November 1st of 2024. The same people that are eligible for the one-time payment would be eligible for this merit increase. In the past, we'd sometimes called an increase like this across the board, but consistent with what we're seeing other institutions in the state do, this we feel comfortable referring to this as a merit increase. The section that we had in 23.3 that dealt with what we had called merit salary increase last time, we're scratching this time. We're not using that complicated.
We don't have to test our mathematical abilities this time.
Well, this will be a little bit easier to implement, and hopefully we can get this done pretty quickly. And Charlie, you're doing a great job. Could you advance to line 86, please? One of the additions that we're making is to try to have a supplemental payment for the tenured faculty who end up in the top two categories on the comprehensive post-tenure review. These are the faculty who are judged by this process to exceed expectations or to meet those expectations. They would get a one-time payment. The supplemental payments for the tenured faculty who do particularly well on the post-tenure review and the faculty who are being promoted, I'd like to like you and your folks to look at those as the university saying, what we want to do is make sure that we're rewarding people who reach important career milestones and continue to accomplish things in their role. So we're trying to reward those tenured employees, not only at the time of promotion, but as they continue to achieve in their role, we'd like to recognize them. So we think this is consistent with that. What we're proposing here is that effective November 22nd, with a payout date of December 13th, all the tenured employees who went through post-tenure review in the academic year we just finished, so we want to reach back into 23-24 and provide those employees a one-time payment, those that exceeds expectations, a one-time payment of $5,500. And those that met expectations, a one-time payment of $2,500. And we'd like to continue to do those one-time payments, make these one-time payments for the tenured faculty that do well in the comprehensive post-tenure review. What we're suggesting is for the academic year we're about to start, 24-25, and subsequent years, that those faculty who are judged to exceed expectations under the comprehensive post-tenure review, that they would get a one-time payment of $5,500, and those that meet expectations would get $2,500. And what we're outlining here is that those one-time payments would become effective 3 weeks before the first pay date in May. And what that would mean for 24-25, and then those payments would be made on the first pay date in May. For 2025, that would mean that the payments would become effective on April 11th and be paid out on May 2nd, just before the 9-month contracts end for the 24-25 academic year. We think we can do that. We think we can make those dates. If for any reason things are delayed in the comprehensive post-tenure review process, we'll want to make those as quickly as we can to reward the people who exceed or meet expectations as part of the comprehensive post-tenure review.
So this is this something that you are just proposing for last year and this coming year, or is this something that you, I guess it will be bargained every year, right? Because
well, the way it's written right now in line 98, it talks about the academic year that we're starting and subsequent years.
Yeah.
So this is written with the intention
of doing it.
That it, this language would function like the promotion raises do. Yes, we can bargain the promotion raises each year, but it's not that they're not going to happen. They're going to happen every year, whether we change the amount or not. So this is something else that we would like to continue to roll from year to year. And there can be discussions at some point about changes to this that we may want to make. But this is what we're proposing.
And for the salary increase, you are not bringing a proposal for a 2-year, you know, because we didn't get any this year. I see. So
yeah, we are recognizing that for 23-24, there was no increase. We're making a record of that. And this is for the present academic year that is about to start, 24-25.
Okay,
Charlie, can we go to about line 118? That's right there. That's good. Thank you. As you've seen, we've already proposed two things that are new for us. Mm-hmm. One is an increase in the raises to the faculty who are promoted either to associate professor or to professor. And we would like to implement these supplemental payments for the tenured faculty who do well through comprehensive post-tenure review. We don't have additional funds for those. The funds had to come from someplace. And what we're proposing to do is to change the number of incentive awards each year. And the incentive awards would now be set up so that they would be for non-tenure earning faculty. The tenured faculty would receive recognition with higher promotion raises, and those that are succeeding would receive additional payments through the comprehensive post-tenure review process, but they wouldn't be eligible for the TIPS and RIAs. So what we're proposing is to make a total of 55 incentive awards available each year to non-tenured employees. 30 of those 55 incentive awards would be TIP awards. We may have to look at the criteria. It's not clear that we're going to be able to get access like we have in the past to some of the SCH data. So rather than calling these productivity data, I want to call them eligibility criteria here in the collective bargaining agreement. One of the things that we're proposing is to take the SOTL awards, which we believe are just examples of research awards, and combining those with the RIAs, and then reducing the total number of research awards, total number of RIAs to 25. And you can see the language about the SOTLs is scratched here. And to come up with these numbers of 30 TIPS and 25 RIAs going forward, these 55 incentive awards, we looked at the last few years and looked at who is winning TIPS, who is receiving the TIP awards, who is receiving the RIA awards and looking at separating those that were tenured faculty from those that were not tenured. And that's how we came up with these numbers. So they're consistent with recent history.
But there's a big difference though, Chuck, because these evaluations or these selections are made by faculty committee and from a number of peers who are maybe experts in the subject matter, whereas the post-tenure review is not done by a faculty committee. So, so there's a big difference in the way the RIA and the TIP operate and the way post-tenure review operates.
So we're not saying that there aren't differences. We're saying this is what we propose. We're looking for how do we find a way to fund these larger promotion increases? How do we find a way to be able to support some kind of supplemental payment for the tenured faculty that go through post-tenure review? And this is what we've come up with. Charlie, can you continue to scroll? Oh, thank you. That's good. Another change that we're proposing is that we would have just TIP and RIA awards, but any faculty member could only win one award in an academic year. They could win either a TIP or a RIA, with the idea that we want to spread this around. We have a lot of faculty that we think are doing well. Some may get a TIP 1 year, a RIA 2 years later. We wouldn't have anybody getting a TIP and a RIA at the same time. And that's what's stated there in 152 to 155. And that'll be revisited later on when we look at the selection process. Something that we want to add in lines 168 and 169, where we talk about some of what takes place in the committees that are looking at the applications for the TIPs and RIAs. We want to make sure that all the information that the committee has, all the deliberations that they do, except the ranked list that they provide at the end of their deliberations, everything is held in confidence in that committee. There have been examples where that hasn't always happened, and it doesn't help anybody. So we like to just go on record and say we think it's important that these committees operate in the strictest confidence. Line 181, we've just added a couple of words there in A, just for additional clarity. Between lines 158 and, or excuse me, 188 and 194, there are some small changes that we're making to suggest that it's not people that are applying for these awards. We're looking at the applications, that the committees are being asked to rank the applications that are submitted, not the applicants. And just wanted to make that clear. We also think in line 196 and 197, we just tried to clarify the language, make it simpler for people on these committees when there are ties that have to be broken. Line 203, again, clarifying, committees recommend. Committees don't award the TIPs and RIAs, they make recommendations that go forward. With the reduced number of TIPs and RIAs that we're proposing, we're also proposing that for the extra college that's composed of the units that are not traditional academic colleges, that there would be one TIP and one RIA available to those employees. And then in lines 212 to 217, we're just saying again that, you know, if someone applies for both a TIP and a RIA and they would be selected, that employee is going to have to make a choice. I want to get the TIP this year. They can apply at another time for a RIA, or if they pick the RIA, they can apply at another time for a TIP. 219. We just want to make that section of the CBA more descriptive of what it talks about. It talks about trustee chair professors, the Pegasus professors, and the excellence awards all in that one section. And then I think we go a little while before we have anything else. Oh, yes. In line 329, what we noticed when we looked at this, the TIPS and the RIAs are arguably the more substantial awards, and the final decision has rested with the provost or designee. And with this line, 328 and 329 applies only to the excellence awards, not to the trustee professorship and the Pegasus professorship. And we think for these awards that are not as substantial as the TIPS and RIAs, that the provost or designee could make those determinations as well. And then we get to section 23, was 7, we would like to call it 8. It deals with administrative discretionary increases. One of the things that really struck us as we've been having our meetings over the last several months is how important it is to the union that the members of the bargaining unit are able to retain their colleagues. Talat, you were very vocal about how losing some of the folks in your department was painful. And I think physics probably got hit harder than most, but it's true that happens. And what we're suggesting here is that the administrative discretion increases are actually an opportunity that we don't want to lose. We don't want to lose the opportunity to be able to provide counteroffers, to provide ADIs to faculty who may be candidates to leave, that maybe they have counteroffers, maybe they're contemplating something. We think it's in the best interest of the bargaining unit and the administration if these ADIs can be made without some of the restrictions that have been placed on us in the past. So that's what we're proposing, that we would be able to continue to make administrative discretion increases with the primary purpose of retaining our quality faculty.
But you took out the limit on it.
Yes, as it is right there. The money's got to be available. It's as it's expressed right now, it's not limited to 1.5% of the salary pool, but money still has to be there to do it. It's not that this is all of a sudden an infinite pool. And Charlie, I think that's about it. Yeah, that's what we've got for Article 23. So, Talat, I thank you and your bargaining unit members for giving us a chance to go through that and explain what we've proposed here. Again, something that we think is important is that we're able to recognize faculty who are really doing well, the tenure track faculty who are achieving the important milestones of tenure, promotion to professor, and also their sustained performance that's recognized through the comprehensive post-tenure review. So it's a lot, that's what we had to say about Article 23.
So there's actually a lot of stuff here, Chuck, and so we will have to take the time, but I do want to express a few things, and I'll do it just, you know, my immediate reaction to some of the items. First of all, thank you for bringing it. I think it is certainly good news that there will be salary increases and there will be one-time payment. We can discuss, you know, how the amount and all that, and we've already given you a table, and if not, we'll bring it again next time about what has gone on in other places. But you know, noting that we did not get any salary increase or one-time payment this year, and knowing that there is something there for next year is good news. So, you know, I do want to acknowledge that. We will take a look and discuss about how to respond to this. I do want to say a few things because you brought in a few rather dramatic changes in some places because, and I'll just tell you my immediate reaction. It's of course just as you hear something and it affects you in a big way. I think one of the things that I have heard my colleagues over and over again in the 16, 17 years that I have been at UCF, it is really the ability to get tips and RIAs. And we can talk about, you know, whether it's a good idea for somebody to be getting tip, RIA, SOTL, everything at the same time. I know colleagues, fantastic colleagues who've gotten that. And we can talk about whether that's good or not. But I think to restrict it, well, you know, on the one hand, you're saying, okay, we only, from what I understand, only non-tenure earning faculty will be applying for TIPS and RIAs. Is that right? Both for TIPS and RIA. And SOTL, what about SOTL?
SOTL is really being rolled into the RIAs.
Okay,
so we view those as additional research awards.
Okay, so that again is a problem because SOTL is, you know, it has its own standing and it does bring people who are creative in a variety of ways. So we can talk about that. So in terms of RIA, it would be really good to know what number of colleagues who are non-tenure earning, who have been receiving RIAs. That's something to know what the number is. I think for to not allow you know others to be competing for something that has been sort of a mechanism for retention. Because particularly when we're looking at junior faculty, and we've had, and again my immediate experiences from physics, and we've had some fantastic faculty that we've hired, and of course they don't get RIA and TIP in their first 5 years. Maybe one or two did, but you know. But the ability to have that is, and it's a competitive award in which they really, it's a faculty committee with very well-defined goals, very well-defined, you know, it's a, you get evaluated by your whole college and then by the whole university, and you're really awarded something for what you've done. And there are peers who are looking at your record. To take that away and replace that with post-tenure review is really problematic. You know, so we really have to think about that because, you know, in some ways you say, well, what does it matter? But no, I mean, you know, I and you know me very well, and I think my whole goal all along that I have been at UCF, and that's your goal and that of a lot of others, is to just make it a place where people can thrive and they can do well and they can, and they stay, and that we provide opportunities and we make it a workplace where they really want to be connected with it. And I think, you know, except for the last year or so, most of my colleagues have felt that way, that, you know, we are here and their incentives and that makes it worthwhile. I think, again, I go back to the same thing over and over again, with the kind of you know, student to faculty ratio that we have, one of the things that sustains people is that, okay, there are these, they still are very creative in the way that they're teaching. And I'm not saying that everybody is going to just give it up. We'll, you know, people are self-motivated, so they don't do it just for the award, but awards certainly help. And so I would be personally very opposed to changing the structure for Rhea and Tip. I think reducing them, that would be a problem. Yeah, this thing about getting one only and all that, those are details, and we can work that out. So I'm sure we'll have discussions about that. So I think there's quite a bit here. I also was wondering, I will say that because there are universities where they've had post-tenure review for a very long time, and there they do like a percentage increase, just like we're doing it here for maybe not as large an increase as we're doing for professor when you go from associate to full professor or assistant to full professor to associate. There are percentage increases, so that is also something that could be contemplated, and again, calculations be done as to where the money is coming from, because I totally agree. In the end, the money, the pie is the same and it has to come from there. So we have to look at that. The other thing is that, because we rely so much on a non-tenure earning faculty to keep this place going and making this place as great as it has turned out to be in the last 20 years or so, we really believe that parity is important. And so, we're very delighted that you've agreed to increase the percentage, 2 percentage points, right? It's 11 now when you go from associate assistant to associate, and or vice versa. I will see the numbers, but there is an increase, 2% increase. You've given us what we asked. So that's really good. But then why not do it for the other as well? Because if anything, they are the instructors and the lecturers are making making less money than those on the professorial ranks. And we rely so much on this very heavy teaching that they do. And without that, how do we maintain the kind of excellence that we really need in order to continue to be one of these top-notch universities in the country? So I think these are just my immediate knee-jerk reactions, you can call them, but I just thought I'll get it off my chest. And again, if anyone else from the bargaining team would like to address any issue, please do so.
Well, Talata, I appreciate your comments.
We'll come back, and I think the response to your article it will be a well thought out one. We will gather and we will come back to it on the 14th. And but again, everything aside, I'm delighted that you've agreed to increase the percentage, at least for some of the people who are going to be promoted, and very delighted that we at least have something to work with in terms of the salary increases. So, I don't want to discount that.
All right. Well, again, I thank you for your comments. When it comes to the promotion increases, those things are tied to the tips and RIAs. That's where some continuing money is available to recognize people with those promotions. So some of these features of changes in Article 23 really are linked. They're tied together. The funds for a post-tenure review, the funds for increased raises for promotion for associate professors and professors is coming from the sure. TIPS and RIA. So that's where it's come from. I just want to make sure it's clear. It isn't, well, we like the raises for the promotions, we don't like the other stuff. They're linked together. So as we talk about these things in subsequent meetings, I just ask that we keep that in mind. It's they're
And
not independent of each other.
so in the same token about the ADIs, where you didn't want to put a limit on it, and I was wondering, you know, with given historical numbers, what do you expect it to be? You know, like, you know, so are you, I mean, of course, the money has to be there. And are you saying that ADIs will only be given if people come with a written offer? Is that how it is
No,
going to be?
No. All I'm saying is we would like to be able to respond. We are less than 4 weeks away from not being able to respond if one of our colleagues gets a counteroffer or gets an offer from another institution.
Right.
It goes away.
Sure.
If there's someone who gets an award that we want to recognize, an external award, and we want to recognize that, that ability goes away in less than 4 weeks until we agree to a new contract that would hopefully reinstitute ADI. So all those decisions in the collective bargaining agreement affect both sides.
Sure.
If the administration is not able to offer an ADI to somebody for whatever reason there may be, that may mean the colleague that one of the folks I'm looking at right now on the screen loses their next door neighbor in the office next to them, somebody that they've worked with for years, and we're not able to do anything. So, you know, we're trying to figure out how do we balance that. We want to make sure that we keep good people that are important not only to the members of the bargaining unit, they're their colleagues, they're their friends, they have the office next door to them. They're important to us as well. They're important to the university because they're succeeding at what they do, and we got it. You know, we felt the pain that was expressed to us as good people are choosing to do something else. And what we're proposing here is a way to maybe ease some of that pain going forward. But it's not the case, as you've already pointed out. Whenever there's an ADI, the money's got to be there. It isn't that we're saying, well, we just want to be able to do whatever we want. That's not the case at all. There's still got to be money available in the colleges in order to make the ADI. But the August 31st end date,
sure,
means somebody gets an offer on September 1st. Even if they got it today, there's not enough time.
Yeah.
There's not enough time to process it and do all the notifications that we have to do. I mean, we're basically done now with ADIs. I'm sure there are some that are in the process of being worked on,
but Chuck,
and will be finalized.
Chuck, but that, you know, the fact that we are so late in this negotiation on salaries and ADIs is not the fault of UFF.
I didn't say it was anybody's fault.
No.
I just said we're here.
I just wanted to make okay.
No, once again, Talat, I'll say I heard you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We appreciate a lot of things that you included. I also wanted to note that even though ADI sound, you know, people have certain ideas about ADI, from what we have seen in the past, you have not used the 1% or the, and now, you know, this time we offered 1.5%, but 1% also. So anyway, we understand that the money has to be there. I think that's good. I think, let me just see, does anybody, is there anything that we should talk about now, or would anybody like to say anything? I mean, we'll certainly have a meeting with the unit members. You know, we will, as we have done in the past, we will send a quick survey to everyone, and so you can respond to us, and that you know, you can certainly let me and Robert your union president? Any questions on anything that you have here or anything else? So we will certainly be getting back to the bargaining unit before we take the next step. But if there's anything right now that what I'm doing is that we are not going into a caucus right now, because I think there are a number of things. Or do people want to have a short caucus on this?
Talat, I just wanted to clarify, because I know it's going to come up in our meetings, that the increase for promotions, I saw the August 7th and August 8th date. Does that mean, I want to confirm, that the 176 people that were promoted in this cycle and those promotions go into effect on August 8th would receive the new structured amount?
They would not.
Would not.
They would not until a fully ratified CBA is in place. Those new percentages would not be in effect.
Okay. That's important, because I know we're going to get that question from.
No, I'm glad you brought it up, Michelle. It's an important question.
It's important.
And none of this goes into effect until we have a fully ratified collective bargaining agreement, and that's why we're trying to get this done.
Robert and anybody, should we take a 5 minute or 10 minute a break to discuss this? Would that be a good idea?
Yes, Tula, I think it would be a good
yes.
idea.
Okay, great. Yeah. Okay, so why don't we take a little break? Would that be okay, Charlie?
Yeah, Tula, why don't we go ahead? Why don't we target 2:05?
That would be great. Yeah.
Is that okay?
That's good. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Jackie, we had recording is on. And we had a good discussion. I just wanted to I think we'll read, well, Charlie will send us the article. And
I did send you the article. Did you not receive it?
Okay, you probably did. I think, let's see, yes, I got it, yeah.
Oh, okay, I sent it right away. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. We had it, and that would be fine. Okay, we'll get back to you. We got a lot of input from everyone, and I think just the bottom line was that first there's a disappointment that because we didn't get a salary increase this year, they were expecting more than 3%. So we'll have to talk about that. The other is that if you look at RIAs and TIPS, These are not one-time payments. These are increase to your salary, to your base salary, and what the other what you're talking about in terms of the post-tenure review, that's a one-time payment. So that's not the same thing. And okay, so we'll talk about that more. And I think we should move on with the rest of our agenda. And I did make some comments on what we have and where we need to work on. And so maybe Chuck, you also have a list of things. You actually have a couple of them to present.
Well, we do. What I'd like to do throughout right now is ask Sandra Sabinski to respond to
Okay.
The comments that you sent us about Article 18.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I'm trying to navigate back between Zoom and Teams.
I know, it's always confusing.
Okay, so would you like to just go through your comments that you said?
Right. So one of our concern was that we publish articles all the time, and we do not get permission from UCF before publishing, and if colleagues are anybody who's doing classified work, then that's a different story, and then that they worry about with their sponsors. So we just wanted to clarify that what is being said here is the common practice that we have right now and not something new that we are adding?
No, that is the practice that we have. And so the definition of work is a more broader definition that's really just derived out of copyright law. Yes. And so in one of the proposed changes that we made, we have had the exception for scholarly works, as you're describing, and that's been, but we have not had a definition in here that was specifically for scholarly works. That's one of the things that we want to add.
Yeah.
And the reason to add that, one of the reasons to add that, is specifically, as you mentioned, to be able to refer to it in the disclosure requirements to say that's not required. Mm-hmm. Scholarly works are not required. So I think if we go down, we'll see, as we continue down, we'll see where that is answered.
Is that where you mean, Sandra? I'm not sure without a line number. Tell me where you want me.
Yes, where you are is where we're adding the scholarly work. So that's where we had before what you're talking about articles, journal articles, okay. But it didn't have a definition. So we just associating a definition in that way, we can more specifically, when we talk to people and even within the article itself, refer more easily to this and more specifically to this exception.
Sure.
That it works out.
Yeah, that's good.
Where do you want next, Linda?
I think your next comment was on round 70.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that was important to some of my colleagues.
Right. So last time, you know, when we updated this article was when the sections on the online courses were revised the way they are now. And so and the definition of those in the different categories. And so in the question, when you say, or the individual who posted it, regular course materials, I'm presuming that you mean something that might have been created
so,
in a live classroom that
so,
was for a,
right. So basically, you know, not just we here, but colleagues at other places as well, when we are teaching a course, we also post them, you know, post our lectures, because they're on topics that is of interest to a lot of people. And it's good to have it, because if we have it on our website or not in web courses, then others have access. So far, that has not been a problem, and we don't want that to become a problem. You know, if it's an online course that is offered by UCF, that's a different thing than I'm teaching and I'm posting whatever I'm teaching on my website.
So I'm not sure if I'm following entirely, but whether it's an online course or whether it's an in-person course, if we go to the... I think it's...
For example, let me give a concrete example. I'm teaching quantum mechanics, okay? And quantum mechanics is of interest to a lot of people. And I post my lectures on my website. And that can be downloaded by anyone.
So if we go back to the definition that we were just talking about for scholarly works...
It's not results of academic research. It's actually it's notes of my lectures that I give.
Okay. And then, so instructional material.
Prepared for, yeah.
Instructional material, because you're asking about, your question I thought was, if you're using those materials in an online course then?
No, the question was that, if I am posting my notes on my website, and then UCF comes and says that, no, you don't have right to do that, because that material actually belongs to a course that you're teaching over here, then that's problematic. Because we would like to share it with the community, just like other colleagues are doing from around the world.
Well, that's a little bit of a different question than what I understood. Yeah. And I think there might be more to that question than just a straight copyright answer. And so I'm a little bit hesitant to offer, you know, what I can say is the article addresses the ownership of the works, but sometimes maybe there are different interests, like you made one mention that has to do with third parties. Even if a faculty member owns a work, the third party has some, you know, like the government, for example, can have some interest in what might be done. I don't know the answer off the top of my head about the question that you're asking about whether UCF has some interest in what's done with the faculty instructional materials. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have to say we'll have to come back to that.
Okay. I think maybe the simple question would be, what about instruction material that a faculty member develops for their own course and that they would like to share, or they do share, with the rest of the world? Where does that fit?
Yeah, I think we'll have to come back to that question.
Okay.
At the time.
Where do you want me to go now for the comments?
Let's see, we were at. So
I think there's only one more.
About 130?
I did, yeah.
And I think that really
that's the one we just did.
Right. So because you don't have to make a disclosure, then that's not required. Oh, then there's another question at 130.
Yeah.
About 130.
Oh yeah, that one was problematic to a couple of people because of the way it is worded.
So the question, the comment is, this is something that could get people in trouble. Seems like the responsibility of the UCF employee to follow UCF's rules. Absolutely. So this is not making a requirement on the outside employer. This is making a requirement on the employee, just to inform the employer of the employee's obligations. So mm-hmm. there's no obligation for the employer whatsoever.
Okay.
I'm not sure how that would get somebody in trouble. I didn't follow
that. This maybe, yeah, the individual was worried about it. Okay. All right. I will read between the lines to make sure that it's clear.
Okay.
So if I may,
yeah.
I don't have the brilliant legal mind that Sandra does, but my layman's explanation of this is, this outside company is not a party to the CBA, so there's no obligation that they have under the CBA. We can't impose any obligation on them as a result of the CBA. This is between the university and its employees, and as long as the employee is doing what they're supposed to do, which is to inform the outside employer of what's going on and so forth, that's all they can do. What the employer does at that point is separate from the CBA. They're not a party to this agreement.
Yeah. All right. I think then there was one small clarification, right, Sandra, right at the beginning, below.
About line 154.
Right.
So this language, the field or discipline, I mean, I agree with you. It's a term that's not concrete, but it really can't be, because all of you all in your specialties are different. And so this is language that's used. I can honestly tell you, I've looked at a lot of these intellectual property, you know, articles and regulations, and I've never seen one that didn't use these same terms. It would be easier for me if it was a term that was super defined in things that I have to look at on the other side. But it's flexible in order to accommodate what you all are each doing in your fields.
Yeah.
Or UCF. So, you know, it's very fact specific.
Maybe what one could say, all inventions made outside the field field or discipline, field or subfield, then maybe that would cover it. But the individual was worried that they were working in a subfield and then they do something in another subfield. So that was the problem. Okay.
Well, I can say this. I do, from time to time, individuals will reach out to me and ask the question, or through the Office of Technology Transfer, if there is any kind of a question. And certainly that happens when people are being hired. They do ask about, they talk about, okay, well, I already have these things going over here. And so that's absolutely encouraged. That's fine.
Okay. Okay, so maybe the thing is that, you know, again, it depends on how you define that situation. If the person has not been working in that area and has not used the resources, then it is a field that they are not associated with.
It's just so fact specific from person to person. Yeah. And plus people shift along as they advance. And
sure.
Then,
sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. I think, yeah. Yeah. Right. Adequate. Right. So there was this question about this out-of-cycle disclosure process.
Yeah, I mean, the process for disclosure of outside activity is pretty well set out in the university, and so it's required at a certain time, and then it's required to be updated within a certain time related to a new activity. I know right now, we just got a notice today, I did, that said, don't make any updates right now because they're in the middle of doing something. But normally they would say, you know, within the prescribed time period that it needs to be updated. That's all very detailed. So I wasn't really sure what the source of the question was because it does seem to be detailed. I wasn't sure where the confusion
was. Oh, so it is what we've been doing right now.
Yes.
Okay. Again, we'll take a look again and we got your clarifications. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Talat, we'll make sure that you get a copy of that with Sandra's comments in there. Okay.
Good.
I'll come back with Chuck. I'll get back with Chuck after we'll talk about the first question that I kind of punted, and then we'll go from there.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Sandra.
Thank you.
Yes, yeah, Sandra, thank you very much. For your support on that.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Talat, one of the things that we said we could do is we could follow up a little bit on Articles 3 and 5.
Uh-huh.
And I think okay if we do that?
Sure.
Charlie's pulling up Article 3. One of the things that we heard before, Claude, you made a strong case for how important an office is for the UFF. We have historically provided an office for the UFF, but it's never been addressed in the CBA, to the best of my knowledge. And what we're proposing to do in section 3.1 is to offer exclusive use of a union office on campus for union business, provided that office is not needed by the university. Right now there's an office that's available. We have no intention of taking that office away at any time, but we can't promise. Can't promise if we continue to hire faculty, hire staff, and at some point we may need that office. There's also the possibility, I suppose, that there'll be some renovation of buildings on campus that would take place, which might mean some employees have to shift from where they normally are to someplace else, at least on a temporary basis. But nothing's changed from our intention, so long as providing an office to the UFF does not mean a university employee has to go without. We're okay. So we're putting that, we're willing to put that in the, okay, in the contract this time. We were also asked about the highlighted language is language that had been proposed to us by the UFF. The UFF has said that they had a right to communicate with the bargaining unit through a mass email system independent of any UCF mass email system or listserv. We're suggesting we modify that. The UFF certainly has the right to initiate communication with the bargaining unit through a mass email system that's independent. And we're just asking that when the UFF sends messages to UCF employees on the UCF email system, that our office, CCAS, is copied on.
Okay.
So we heard you. That's all we've got in Article 3 is two things on the first page.
Thank you.
And, you know, we're offering that office. I see Robert's got a question.
Robert, this is, go ahead.
Sorry, Charlie, can you put it back up? So my question is about the second highlight. Okay, Chuck, my question is, don't you do this already? Because I know my mass emails are read by your office. What's the difference if I forward them to you where you're already reading them anyway, right? I'll say this, and hang on. In a previous bargaining session, Craig mentioned one of my emails that I know he and I never had a conversation about. So I know you read my emails. I know their subject. And I would imagine if you don't, and if your position is we don't read your emails, we don't have the ability to read your emails, then you might want to look into hiring new people in IT.
Well, there's always new people coming on board in IT.
I send those emails assuming that you read them because you have the ability and, you know, you have the know-how. I mean, this is a little thing. I'm not going to make a big point about this, but I mean, I just want to acknowledge the reality. The reality is you're already reading my emails.
I don't agree with that.
I do want to interject in where I have been called out by Dr. Casanello. I don't read your emails unless I receive an email to myself. So to say that the university is reading your emails, if your emails are forwarded to people, that's a different thing. But to say that the university is reading emails that you send out is, I mean, we can get into the nuances, but just, I don't know if you were joking or not, but not comfortable with the way that you described.
So Craig, what you're, to clarify,
I'm not going
to
get in an argument with you.
No, this isn't an argument.
Craig, you're saying that the university is reading your emails is not appropriate.
Okay, so to clarify then, Craig, what you're saying is if my emails are read, it's because they were forwarded.
I'm sure there can be a whole different scenario of circumstances. If emails are forwarded to people or received by people, then they are probably read. But to my knowledge, for you to say that what Chuck is putting in there is already going on of emails, of what I heard you saying, and maybe this isn't that, that the university is reading emails that you are sending that aren't sent to people. If that's what you're saying, I don't believe that that's correct.
All right, thank you for the clarification, Craig. So then, isn't there a process though that you all could flag emails in their red? I mean, is there like an administrative process? Or is that only for employees?
I'm not sure I understand.
I think what you're trying to get to, Robert, is that we are expected to restrict the emails to certain topics, right? And so what you're saying is that how does the university ensure that the email doesn't contain a topic that they're not allowed to send? Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't have a problem with this. And Craig, actually, thank you, Craig, because Craig actually answered my question. So
yeah. So the question that you're asking now is that how would you know if the if emails that are sent by anyone, actually, not just the union president, that that you know that this email contains something that shouldn't be forwarded?
I mean, anything could be forwarded. I mean, I'm operating on the assumption, you know, there's nothing I put in the email that the university cannot read, right?
Okay.
So I mean, otherwise, you know, why would I put it in there?
Right. So I think what they're saying is that this is basically you do the monitoring yourself of what you put in, right? That's.
Well, I mean, there are legally things I can say in a mass email, and there are things legally I cannot say in a mass email, and I know the difference between the two. And there's nothing I ever put in a mass email that can't be read by the university. And I was under the assumption, because things have been said to me over the years, that my emails were read by Millikan Hall. But if Craig is saying that is not the case, I was given false information, I will accept that.
I am not saying you're given false information. I don't know what you've been given. To my knowledge, I don't know what you want me to say other than, to my knowledge, I don't think people are just reading your emails. If your emails make their way to Millikan Hall, or when you say Millikan Hall, to people, then they're read. I'm not trying to be coy with a response. To my knowledge, nobody is reading just your email. If your email is sent to somebody, emails are, I'm not going to get into specifics, but emails can be forwarded, as I presume you're aware. I don't know what.
So, but Craig, I'm sorry. I don't mean it. Right. So Craig, just if you don't mind, just to follow up. So what you're saying is all of my emails are not forwarded as a policy.
Dr. Casanello, I am not aware of a policy of forwarding your emails. That's all I can say. I am not aware of that. So.
All right. Thank you, Craig.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to just weigh in briefly, hopefully just to clarify things. Occasionally, one of us may receive either a hard or a soft copy of an email. Occasionally.
No, I'm aware of that. No, I'm aware of that because I know Craig has forwarded stuff for me that was forwarded to him. So I've seen that transaction happening. What I am saying is, years ago when I first started the mass email, and I'm not going to say any names, is someone from your side of the neighborhood said, be aware, we read your emails. So if you say anything in there, you know, be careful what you say. That warning was issued to me. So based upon that, I just assumed my emails were being read. If Craig is saying that's not the case and the information I was giving years ago was not correct, fine.
I am saying I am not aware of that. That's what
that's a different thing than saying it's not happening.
Well, I'm not going to sit here and say anything that I don't know. So I'm not trying to hijack the conversation, but I can't answer anything that I'm not.
I just want to I'm trying not to be difficult here, but I've been sitting on this piece of information for a while now, and this has given me the opportunity to just say, just to disclose, this is what I understand the reality to be. In Craig's reality, this does not exist, and I accept that. But I'm just putting this out there that I operate under the assumption you're already reading my emails. But we can stop here. We don't need to go any further. This is not happening.
That's not happening. Unless we are given a hard or soft copy of the email.
Okay. I don't personally have an issue with what you're proposing here. I just wanted to clarify this because you've given me the opportunity to bring this issue up that's been presented to me over the years.
I want to say thank you for bringing it up, because if there is a misunderstanding about what we do, I'm glad we've had this opportunity to clear that up.
Well, I don't know. It's been cleared up. It's just been cleared up that Craig is not. Craig has no knowledge of it. No one else has said they have no knowledge of it. But thank you, Craig. I appreciate it. I think I'll still operate on the assumption that you're reading my email. That seems to be the safest track for me.
Well, I think we should always operate under that assumption, because email is public.
And actually, that's what we're saying here in the comments, because an email that's sent to the university may be a public record that we have to be aware of, and we're just saying we want to be aware of it. That's all.
I mean, just maybe we can return to this next time, but just, and I'm saying this with all sincerity, Chuck, you might want to write this down. Couldn't it be possible that within the server system, you could flag the email and then it just automatically comes to you? And then if there's future presidents who might not know the mass email system as well as I do, you will get the email in compliance with this article if we end up agreeing to this. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like the forwarding could be automated as opposed to me having to, or the president or future president having to each time know to include this email in the context. I mean, maybe check and see if it's possible. That's my question.
It may be possible, but what it would require is the university's resource would have to be screening all inbound emails to find the ones that come from you. And I'm not sure that the university wants to dedicate its resources. As interested as we all are in your emails, Robert.
I know you are, Chuck.
But I think the simplest thing is if there's something that goes to a ucf.edu email address, just send us a copy. Just CC us and we're done.
Or we can go with status quo. Okay.
Yeah.
Or we can go with status.
So anyhow, that's what we propose for Article 3.
Great.
And then we had also proposed an Article 5 a couple of sessions ago, and nothing's changed. Charlie, if you want to yes, thank you. That's three, no, though. That's not five.
Oh, gosh. Sorry.
No problem.
There we go.
This is the same thing that we proposed last time. We again want to reiterate that UCF is supportive of academic freedom for all its employees. We also want to emphasize that compliance with applicable laws, rules, and regulations is important to us as well. So that was a change that we had proposed to Article 5. That's originally we had proposed status quo for Article 5. That's what we're proposing. We've added a comment to perhaps explain it a little bit better. Why we're interested in making that change. But that's really no different from the last time we presented Article 5.
Okay.
And those are the things that we had to share with you today, Talat, and I appreciate having the opportunity to share 23, 18, 3, and 5 where we are on the agenda that I'd shared with you this morning. I had suggested that maybe we could take a few minutes and talk about our strategies. We have 15 articles that are still out there without any agreement on. There's three articles that neither side has brought to the table yet. That's Article 8. We are working on Article 8.
Right.
I hope to have that soon. I'm not promising next Wednesday, but
right. So
a high priority for me. And there's Article 30 and 32, which are typically articles that we do at the end. 32 is definitions in case there's any new terms that we want to define in the CBA. Article 32 is our chance to do that. And Article 30 is where we talk about the duration of the agreement and what we may want to bring up.
Mm-hmm.
During the intervening years. We're in a full book year right now. Next year, there may be some articles that one side or the other would want to bring up. Since we've only put information for salaries for the 24-25 academic year, I'm sure that both sides will want to open Article 23 for 25, 26, and there may be others. So I think we're working on an 8. 32 may have minor changes. At 30 is usually something we can do pretty quickly at the end, but there are 12 other articles.
Sure.
That are out there that, you know, we need to come to some closure.
Right. And so, well, we would, we had actually worked out on some of these, but I think we'll just bring them next time, because it would be good to go line by line. And I don't see many issues with 9. In 10, I believe we have a couple of points, which are, I think, minor. 16, I think we, again, you know, I don't want to misspeak, but I think we're very close on 16. And then 19 and 20 are the two in which we wanted to bring you language that had to do with arbitration. And that one, there is FSU is looking into it right now. FIU has already done it. And so what we will do when we come next time is come up with the language that others are using, because I think, we had already sent you something from FIU, but then there are other examples as well. And I think if we did that, then that could tie up 19 and 20 it's not very problematic. 22 is the one where we differ, because, the changes that we would like to keep status quo on 22. And 24 is, again, where there are changes which do not make sense. This is where it's about employee benefits. And then I don't think the changes in 22 that the 24 that you proposed, we will have to probably talk about it again. It didn't seem to me to make that they were needed. We would like to keep status quo, so we can go over that. And so when I looked at that, I think I'm of course trying to be optimistic here. It could be that we are still hung up on some of these, but let's say that on 19 and 20, if we could agree to maybe the way they'll, FSU model or some other model or a model that suits us better than any one of those. But, you know, this has been an issue on each campus. And so each one of them is coming up with a solution. So I think, and we are very close on 19 and 20, I think. I think it's only a question of if there is no arbitration, then basically, what do we do? And that's where the issue comes in. Other than that, I think 22 is the one which is where we again would like things to be parallel and in the two tenure earning and non-tenure earning tracks. And one of the things was really again to, if you could give us some data on the number of people in non-tenure earning category who were seeking 1 year sabbaticals, two semester rather than one semester. So that would be good to know what we are doing. And I think that is there was another one where we which is the one which is on, that's the one, sabbaticals, which is the one on leaves. That's the one we're not.
That's 17.
Oh, that's 17. So I think there are issues on 17. 17 we need to discuss. Yeah. So we would like status quo on 17. Yeah. Robert?
Chuck, I would just have a question when you get a second.
Sure.
So I just want a clarification. Article 23 from 2023 is not connected to full book because the 24 article 23 should be in full book. Do I have that correct or am I incorrect?
Well, it's why I've proposed that we include a statement in the full book that says for 23-24, basically we did nothing. In section 23.3.A, I think it says something like no salary increase or one-time payment was offered in 2023, 2024.
So what we agree to, if we say if we were to agree to this 23 you presented today, that then we would not have a 23 in this September.
No, we would.
As soon as it's ratified, we would.
Okay, so I'm sorry, Chuck. Take me through this. Now you don't need to pull it up, Charlie.
Well, right now.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we will have a 23 for salaries effective.
But then we open up a new 23 this September, right, Chuck?
Right.
No, not 23. We open up the 25-26.
So if we agree to this 23, then we're just an entire year no salary raises.
Oh, I'm sorry. When you're saying 23, I was hearing the year 23.
Sorry, no, I meant Article 23.
Okay,
sorry.
So Article 23 will open to discuss 25-26 raises.
Right.
And also 26-27 raises. We
right.
Open,
so
unless we close it now, it's open to negotiate again.
So we can go like a whole year without 23 and then it would just clock into the next cycle, the next academic year?
The last 23 that we ratified, which was for 22 through 24, still applies. And it says, until we get a new full book, until we replace that Article 23.
Okay, but so my original question was that so September 2023's Article 23 was intended to be part of the full book.
No, it was intended to be an off-year bargaining. It was intended to be a reopener in 23-24. We were not able to come to agreement on that. What we're proposing is that we recognize that fact in the 24-27 full book. We address the salaries for academic year 24-25 immediately. And when we get to Article 30 and talk about reopeners for 25-26, Article 23 will be one of the ones that we want to reopen in probably one of the things that I mentioned to Talat. I am hopeful personally that we can get on a different bargaining rhythm so that we're taking care of salaries at the beginning of an academic year and not trying to play catch up in the spring.
So
what I would like to do, this is Chuck speaking right now. My preference would be to do what we're doing now in the summertime, addressing salaries for the coming academic year every year. Just do this every year rather than go into March and say, you know, do we have any money left from the current academic year? That's my preference.
So
I'm speaking as an individual on that.
So, Chuck, what would be a timeline to think about that for the next salary increase would be that we give you something in, let's say, when we have the reopener, which is when, in November?
No, I'm saying, what again, this is just Chuck speaking.
Yeah.
I would like to say that we reopen in the spring. Maybe we do it March, April, as the state legislature's working on the state budget. And, you know, I don't know what else we may propose as reopeners right now. But instead of opening in November, we open in the spring. Because for the academic year 24-25, as soon as we're done with this full book, we've got a salary article that takes us through until next August, basically, until August 25. In the spring of 2025, I'll just throw out April 1st as a date. I don't know that we're going to have budget information that will allow us to deal with 23, but there may be other articles that we want to reopen as well. We could address those beginning in April. And then when the budget information becomes available, we can talk about 23 and try to do something early in the fall as we're trying to do now, and do that starting this year and every year from now on. That is Chuck's preference.
And then we'll have some clarity once we finish negotiating Article 30, because that will have the dates in it when we start.
Okay, that would be great, because you know the Article 23 that we sent for the year that has gone was a long time ago.
We know. Okay. Yes.
So we were also hoping that by April you would have a response, right? So if you had a response, then we would be done before summer started.
But we would have been done before summer started for the last academic year.
Right. But let's talk about this when we get to Article 30.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be good. Okay, I think...
That means a lot. What that means is if you want to get to Article 30, we got to get all the other ones done.
That's right.
And we're interested in doing that as well.
Yep. So let's look forward to August 15th and then...
14th, isn't it the 14th?
14th. Yeah. And we do it on Zoom?
I think we're set up.
Okay, that's fine.
For that way.
It's probably more convenient for people. Yeah, that's fine. All right. And if we are so lucky to get an agreement, we come and shake hands.
We can always do that. Shall I stop the recording then?
I think we're done.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Charlie. Yes.